The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. BellaCatering.com.au, one of the best catering companies in Sydney, but in the time of COVID, in this garbage, fire, doom scrolling, the world is ending as we know it, year of 2020, has meant that this terrific and awesome family catering company led by Glenna Maria, who I love and adore, has pivoted to home delivery. So if you want, while you're in New South Wales, while you're around the Sydney area, if you want great home-cooked feeling, delicious catering to your home, Bella Catering is where you got to go. They're absolutely amazing. They have a variety of cuisines. They're incredible. BellaCatering.com.au is where you can dial them up, find them, order something. Hell, order before the second wave gets here. And order seconds for the second wave. They're the best. Thank you for listening. We have a banger of a week for you. Now, onto the show.
Some guy decided to drive to Kenosha with his militia buddies to protect a business, and apparently ended up shooting three people and killing two. But don't worry, the business is okay. And let me tell you something. No one drives into a city with guns because they love someone else's business that much. That's some bullshit. No one has ever thought, oh, it's my solemn duty to pick up a rifle and protect that TJ Maxx. They do it because they're hoping to shoot someone. That's the only reason people like him joined these gangs in the first place. And yes, I said it, a gang. Enough with this militia bullshit. This isn't the Battle of Yorktown. It's a bunch of dudes threatening people with guns. And while what happened with those shootings last night is tragic, what happened afterwards is illuminating. Because it made me wonder. It really made me wonder why some people get shot 7 times in the back, while other people are treated like human beings and reasoned with and taken into custody with no bullets in their bodies. How come Jacob Blake was seen as a deadly threat for a theoretical gun that he might have and might try to commit a crime with, but this gunman who was armed and had already shot people who had shown that he is a threat was arrested the next day, given full due process of the law, and generally treated like a human being whose life matters? How did Dylan Roof shoot up a church, James Holmes shoot up a movie theater, and both live to tell about it? Why is it that the police decide that some threats must be extinguished immediately while other threats get the privilege of being diffused? I'm asking these as questions, but I feel like we know the answer. The answer is that the gun doesn't matter as much as who is holding the gun. Because to some people, black skin is the most threatening weapon of all.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. It is now the 87th minute of Alan J. Pakula and Robert Redford's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. And I've got a great guest for you. And before I knew that this guest was a freelance writer, around a bunch of places like Birth, Movies, Death and Real Honey and the Globe and Mail and a senior contributor at the Film School Rejects, I just thoroughly enjoyed her Twitter. It is such a joy. It is just full of exactly the kind of nonsense that I'm about. And so I, as a host of this show, not only am I on the lookout for people who I know are going to be either tremendous journalistic contributors specifically or great film minds that I already know of, but I'm always on the lookout for folk who I haven't had a chance to talk to, but that I sort of admire from afar or bring me internet joy. That is this person. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my distinct pleasure to welcome Anna Swanson to All the President's Minutes. Anna, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Your brand of nonsense is my brand of nonsense, and I enjoy it. I enjoy it very much.
I do think we're both. Sorry, I interrupt you.
I
think we're just both, like, we have those obsessive tendencies where when we love a movie, we love it with our whole soul. So
yes,
I very much respect that.
Yeah, there is a kinship and in a mutual obsession. The greatest compliment I ever received was, I compliment your obsessions. And I was like, yes, that's a very nice thing to say. So I appreciate that. So here we are. This wasn't a movie that you had been super familiar with before I asked you to do the show, but I hadn't seen it, but
I did love,
I said to Anna, I sort of said, look, I'd love to have you on the show. If you can get a chance to watch it, like, brand spanking new eyes on this thing is always something that's really fascinating for me in the middle of like a project where people are usually obsessed with the movie. So I was excited to talk to her anyway. And then I just received, it was like Redford putting a red flag in his pot. I just received the meme of Al Pacino from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as Marvin Schwartz come into my inbox that just said, what a picture. And I was like, yes, she's put the bat signal up. She's ready to go. So first time watcher, really enjoyed the film. I'm excited to hear you, what you thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was one of those films that, like, I'd always kind of heard was like great. And obviously everyone I know loves it because it's a great movie. And people sort of very specifically saying to me, like, you will like it. Because mostly just because I think Zodiac is one of the greatest films of all time.
Yes.
And they're like, well, how have you not seen All the President's Men? And I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. So it's definitely been on the watch list for a while. I think it just felt very, like, monumental.
Yes.
Where I'm just like, I want, like, this doesn't feel like a movie that I'm just like, I'm going to, you know, put this on because I just want something on. Like, I want to be in the right headspace. I want to be in the right mood. I want to feel like I'm committing to something. And I think you just gave me a really good incentive to finally get to it. But yeah, I mean, it lived up to the hype, which I think is probably the biggest compliment you can give for a movie like All the President's Men, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's so like you just said, it's kind of like omnipresent. It's out there. It's like it's mm-hmm. one of those genre. If it's a blind spot in the genre, you feel it. You don't get to sneak up on it. That's the other thing that some people don't get. It's like, you're like, oh no, I didn't get to see that. That's, you know, mm-hmm. and there's a guilt that's immediately there. Like I had a recent sneak up viewing of a great Sidney Lumet movie called Night Falls on Manhattan. It was one of the 90s ones. Like, mm-hmm. so it's really terrific, and it's rare to get access to it. I got an upcoming release. But it's not like Dog Day. It's not like it's not like admitting to people who are like, oh, I haven't seen Dog Day Afternoon, because people would be like, what? Like, spit take, you haven't seen Dog Day or something like that. So it's just one of those things where, you know, sometimes it's intimidating and then you're like, yeah, I'll get to it. I'll get to it when I get to it. And you sort of push it away because you start being petulant about people doing that.
This is the part where I also admit I've never seen Dog Day Afternoon.
There you go. That's a big one, right? So like, that's you have something tremendous to look forward to. But if you'd seen like that, that's the challenges when you're piecing together directors and things like that. And if you like Fincher mm-hmm. like that, it's just that whole era. Maybe I'm just I am definitely more obsessed than most people, but I'm more obsessed with that era than most people. So I tend to like mm-hmm. through it. So Zodiac's one of your favorites. Did you see not only in the David Shire score, but did you see a kinship with Fincher and Goldman and trying to make the sparkling repartee and just really all the authenticity? Was that, were you just seeing it all written,
written in Fincher's Zodiac as you were watching Presidents?
Oh, definitely. And I think just this, like, this obsession, this, like, incredible detail, the minutia of it,
yes,
and just the process of it all, like, it's fantastic. Yeah.
So I didn't give you just any old minute. The entire sequence from about minute 75 through to 90, like this 15-minute chunk of the movie, features three, because there's sort of like there's like the three different setups, I guess, if you like, of Hoffman talking to Jane Alexander's bookkeeper, real life character is Judy Hoback Miller, sitting in her home, eking out all this information. She's only giving him initials. They go back to Woodward's house. Bernstein's jumping off the walls. He's spitting out information. He's pulling out trash out of his pockets that he's written on through their entire conversation. And then there's this great strategizing scene together where they try and figure out how the hell they're going to get confirmations of the initials, which is just music in and of itself. But then we get this great scene where you see it executed. And so the minute that we're getting to talk about today is just one of those beautiful things of, like, if you talk about process porn and Manny Farber calls it termite art, you know, like, this is as great as it gets, because it's just like, you see the conversation, the beginning of the information, the strategizing, and then you watch it happen. And it's just all that beautiful thing. It's, I think, a thing that sports movies do really well, when you see a plan come together, when you see the training montage and all those sorts of things. It's like this deeply, innately satisfying thing as you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big fan of heist movies.
Yes.
And, like, for this sort of, you know, extended sequence you've been talking about, the last sort of 10 minutes of the movie, like, it really boils down to just several conversations.
Yes.
But those several conversations kind of feel like just such a tense, like, thriller moment of the film. Like they're pulling off a heist.
Yes.
Like of that nerves on edge, like formulating every detail. And yeah. And I mean, that conversation sort of planning out, like, the, you know, I'll say this, you say that, you know, P is Porter. We know that. And just the strategy of it. It's so brilliant the way I think it just takes, like, this small little thing of, like, figuring out an initial, but it becomes such a monumental achievement just to get these little pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah, it's great that you say that, because so many guests have said it, but I think it's important to kind of get, like, maybe haven't said it as, like, sort of succinctly, is this whole movie almost boils down to conversations. And what's funny,
yeah, exactly.
Like, if you're trying to tell people, like, oh, what happens? Well, a whole bunch of people have a whole bunch of conversations, and a whole bunch of people really don't want to say what they're going to say, start feeling compelled to say things. And these guys are there, you know, have to be Johnny on the spot for catching those moments where these people are willing to make their confessions, and then get it, and then immediately, like, sometimes it's the confirmation and they've got to run off and do something with it. But for a movie that is essentially a whole bunch of people talking, just like a 20 vignettes of people talking, it is so damn riveting. And exactly as you said, I think that mounting heist thing that is great, because with a heist, you're like, oh, we've got to break into the building, and then we've got to get past the security guards, and then we've got to get to the safe, you know, and, you know, no one, you know, Steven, it's great that you say that, because Steven Soderbergh, who kind of, like, you know, reignited, you know, blockbuster heist movies with The Oceans, is also an incredibly huge fan of this movie. So he gets...
Doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. He gets the mounting, like, element, how important they work together. And in this movie, obviously the stakes are huge, but it's small conversations. It's not like the great Carl Reiner putting on an accent, but it's definitely something that's just as fun and just as cool. What's you're coming back to this movie, you're a big fan of Zodiac, you guys at the Film School Rejects it obviously have an opinion of, like, the Redfords and the Hoffmans, seeing these guys together, because it's your first time with them together. How was your experience with that? Because I always, like, wonder what people think of, like, Redford as much as an actor as I do as a director later on, and then just, like, a force of, like, you know, a force of innovation and, like, independent film later on in his career.
Yeah. I mean, I think Robert Redford is just one of those people where, like I can't say I'm too well versed in his filmography. There's so much I have yet to see. You know, I still got those blind spots I got to fill in, but I want to sort of like savor those experiences. Like he's not a, you know, actor, director, whatever, filmmaker who I like want to sort of like binge watch. I want to sort of savor that because I think he's just so good and he's so perfect in this. And then, I mean, Dustin Hoffman also just phenomenal actor, you know, I like, and I think the two of them so good together. And the sort of like the second half of this minute where it's just sort of them typing up and watching TV and listening. I love the moment where the news report like first mentions that they're talking about Watergate and they both sort of snap to attention in sync with one another. And Hoffman just like stops typing. And I mean, even just the sound design of how like the clicking of the typewriter and it's so pronounced and then it just cuts out the second Watergate is mentioned. And they both sort of sit there, like almost not breathing, because they're so focused.
it's
great.
It's one of those things that it's like it's the deepest satisfaction that it almost feels like that little moment in sound design is like finally, mm-hmm. they're talking about us. A news reporter in that, you know, that's one of the greater concerns earlier on with Bradley and his international editor and Howard is that they're sitting around the table, Martin Balsam's character, they're sitting around the table and they're going, no one's printing our stuff, which is like a massive indication that what they're doing is maybe off the wall or like doesn't, you know, has inherent risk. And so here is where they start to see it. So let's actually dive into the minute. So for folks who are listening, we've seen the strategy of the boys unpacking the bookkeeper's confession. We've seen them talk about how they're going to get their confirmations. The scene is so tonally different from mm-hmm. what we've seen before. It's actually such a relief because that scene that is so tight and so tense and just, you know, lamp lit and claustrophobic is now this beautiful like cone of silence and greens and, you know, Jane Alexander's wearing a beautiful dress and the guys at least look fresh faced. They don't look like they're dosed on 25,000 cups of coffee there. Mm-hmm. It's actually a lovely different scene. And then the confession really starts to pour out and it's actually this great moment. So we are at the 87th minute. If you want to queue it up to watch along, because there's got to be one of you out there who's listening that is doing it at the same time. It is 1 hour, 26 minutes on your dial, all the way up to 1 hour, 27 for the 87th minute. Anna and I are going to watch it along right now together. You guys are going to listen along and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Who's P? P we know is Porter. You said 25 grand. Is that how much Porter got? Was it more? Was it more than 50,000? Was Magruder the only M to receive money?
Who told you about Porter?
I'd like to move on now to the subject of the break-in at the Watergate and the controversies that keep coming up out of that. It is recently, very recently, been reported now that some documents were torn up at the committee to re-elect the president. Are you investigating the tearing up of those documents?
Well, I think that came out in a story in the Washington Post.
Yes.
I think the investigation...
All right, we can go back. We'll just cut that in. Anna?
Yeah.
What a picture. What a minute.
What a picture.
What a picture.
Yeah. You could do the podcast where it's just like genuinely frame by frame. What a picture. It doesn't even have to move.
No, just it's there's a really great editor also who gives great Twitter, Vashi Nedimansky on Twitter. And he likes to go, he's a very mercurial guy. Obviously he's a film editor and he's like a professional, but like when he gets obsessed with the movie too, like he's a great student of cinema. So he'll go and like do shot counts and, you know, he goes mm-hmm. to some of our favorite filmmakers, like your Paul Thomas Anderson's and your Finches, and he times out their shot counts, but he really loves All the President's Men. And he's been on the show and he's definitely coming back for a second helping. And Vashi recently has been going and like trying to get every shot of the movie. You know, he's already done one collage, but like, you know, when you see all these shots, you literally could just go, hey, Vashi, can you just like copy paste Marvin Schwartz alongside everyone? Because it's just so good. But this scene I love, I love, you know, when you can sort of tell a story in tones of like these three scenes, because they're so different, mood and tone wise. And even though like you go from like one little lounge room nook to an apartment, which are essentially like lamp lit, like it's like late at night in Woodward's apartment. But I love the tones of those scenes and the feelings. And then you get to this scene and unlike any other scene really, I guess, in the rest of the movie, it just instantly feels with all the lightness and all the color and all the fresh air that they're going to get the information that they need. It like doesn't even feel like for a second that they're not going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think like, well, we should talk about this in the show more, I think, but just the way that like, I mean, we could talk about performance all day, but I think very specifically what we, the way that both of them play on like confidence and like insecurity, where it goes from this sort of like coffee fueled rant of, you know, what are we doing? How are we going to do it? To sort of obviously meticulously crafting out like, well, you say that and I say this and this is how we're going to trick her. But then in the actual scene, we see how the way it plays out and they come across as so much in charge of the conversation. When we know, of course, that she can withhold information and screw up their entire plan.
Yes.
And yet they both sort of convey that, I mean, for the characters, slightly performative confidence, but they do it so seamlessly. It's just brilliant. I mean, I think we could talk about that for like an hour here, just like how they play that.
And also what's funny is Hoffman has already said in a previous scene to Jane Alexander, we don't reveal our sources. And in that moment, he's so holding back just the like the impulse to like push her beyond her limit that he has to kind of like, he just mm-hmm. goes, we don't reveal our sources. And then he moves on because he knows that that doesn't give her any comfort. And so the way that they can come in now and say it all and just deliver it straight and have her look at them and they're both unwavering. That's what's so great about their faces. It's like, there's no good cop, bad cop. It's just, you know, you want to say it's just the cops, but it's just these two guys who are completely sure of themselves. And in that moment, mm-hmm. you can watch the comfort of her. Like they know someone else has talked. Like that's how I read it. I don't know if it's definitely the confidence too. It's everything about that confidence. And I also mm-hmm. love, and this is what heist movies do great. It's like, I love watching an actor be a performer or be a character in a movie and then that character have to play a character. And in this moment, these guys are playing the yes. character. They're playing the character of very confident journalists. And up mm-hmm. to this point, they haven't really been able to be that confident because no one is spilling the beans. No one's doing anything. They're just like on a knife's edge the entire time.
Yeah. Aren't we all playing the character of very confident journalist?
I've been playing the character of very confident podcaster for some time right now, and I'm just hoping that one day he turns up somewhere in there. But yeah, it's just one of those things that you just, when you're in the role, you're like, these people around me seem to believe that I can do this, so I've got to do it. But and for these guys, yeah. like if we don't, they're so out on a limb. That's what's so great. Mm-hmm. And we're coming up to that moment in our very minute that we sort of started the lead into this conversation is. The vindication and the validation of all the work that they've been doing is coming up like a news report on national television talking to a very prominent political, you know, intelligence mm-hmm. agency figure is about to pose questions from their articles to them. And it's directly as a result from that. And I love that you said the power, despite the confidence, the power is completely in her hands. She's already mm-hmm. doing what she feels is too much. The initials are too much information. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no way. It's not enough. And then going back, and doing it, and she's much more unguarded. You know, she's sitting out in front of her house. She's having a beautiful iced tea. The day looks gorgeous, and so I think you feel a little bit more comfortable if you're sitting out on your porch and you're happy and you're just having a read of the paper or whatever she's reading. And it's like, oh, okay, now I have to put the shields back up to protect myself from you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, like she could be like, I'm not telling you anything, and it could end there, and that would be it, right? I mean. Wouldn't be very cinematic, but like we know that that's an option that's on the table here. If they don't orchestrate this well, and if they don't go through with it, you know, in the way that they should, right? Like it's all hinging on this.
Yes.
In a lot of ways it is. Yeah.
And in this sequence, I don't know what it is about it, but in the staging.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Of the camera at the end of the first scene, it feels like a surveillance camera, like coming down onto the scene. In the way that it's anchored, doing this sort of like, you know, sort of slow pan through the room, following the energy of Hoffman, it's still very anchored. It still feels like you're being watched in this omnipresent moment. And in this scene, everything, like the greenery, the outside, everything's out in the open. It doesn't feel like, you know, the barriers are sort of imagining. They come through a tiny little gate. Everything feels like it's more open, but it feels more safe for her to say it. It's just everything about the tone is reinforcing that they're going to get what they're going to get. But I just also love that like the way that the scene is shot, it doesn't feel like they're being watched in this scene like they have sort of in the others. It very much feels like an organic, you know, traditional cinematic dialogue. Eyelines, two shot, set up nicely, and really it's just the reinforcing of their faces. And just also Bernstein playing, not us, like this is what's so great about the confidence that you were talking about before, is Bernstein basically not saying anything. Like he just has one or two like lines in this exchange and just lets Woodward carry with it, whatever the strategic reason for that. And it just nails it, because he just gets to sit there and sort of nod and be reassuring that, you know, we're going to protect you, and we're just confirming, you know, we know a few of these details, and just that way that they do it is just great. That echo of those two guys.
Yeah. And his two lines are pre-scripted. It's totally inorganic what he's supposed to say. Like, it's all been pre-planned.
Yes. And they've done such a good job to pre-script and plan those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wait, what am I? I'm going to say that. No. And you're going to say that. I love that. That's the other thing I also love. And I wish kind of more of it in the heist genre is half saying what the plan is going to be, like sort of half messily saying it. And then the hard cut is so great, because it cuts in the middle of this plan and then you watch them execute it to perfection. And so you don't need to see anymore. The inference is like, it's done, you know?
Yeah.
We don't need to do a quick cut back to show them how well they executed and orchestrated it before. We're just going to assume that they did it, and that's why they're doing it so well now.
Mm-hmm.
What else did you like about the movie? Was there any other highlights?
I mean,
I've made you scrutinize this scene. I've made you scrutinize their revelation. Is there any other particular scenes or moments that really resonated with you when you were watching this? Because in Zodiac, as a person whose next project that I'm embarking on is Zodiac, when I think of Zodiac, like my experience with it changes. It changes with, am I with Graysmith this time? Or am I now with Paul Avery for the duration? Or am I with all of these wonderful cops like Elias Codius, like these random terrific character actors? You know, I feel like it's like a moving feast. Am I in the cinematography this day? Am I in the script this day? Am I just in love with Brian Cox every day? Yes, all those answers. But I feel like when you watch Presidents, it's hard because I'm going through every minute sort of chronologically at the moment. But I just wonder what other scenes really resonated with you.
Yeah. So in the sort of like single scene sense, that's a tongue twister. But in the single scene sense, the moment where Woodward is just like walking down the street and it's dark and he sort of like, he turns around, it sort of tracks in on him. And just like the way that scene, you just feel the like paranoia and the fear. And I like kind of audibly gasped when I saw that moment. So I need to mention that, because it's just so brilliant. But I think just overall, like, I mean, obviously I very much enjoyed this viewing, but I think it's so rich and complex and every detail is just so perfect. Like it's a film that I really want to watch again. Mm. And I can already kind of tell that I think it's going to be a film that I find new things on every watch. Like, I don't think this is a film that, and maybe you can speak to this, because if anyone has solved this film, it's probably you. But I don't think you'll ever sort of solve it, like boil it down to a single thing. Like, there's always going to be something new to see, you know, like you said, different characters to follow. And yeah, I'm very much looking forward to future viewings.
Yeah, I would say to you that I get excited about doing this show, and especially talking to people like yourself who haven't seen it before, because you just sort of help underscore a moment, because I hadn't as in a pronounced way thought about the sound design and the way that they're hammering on the typewriter and the way that it stops in the scene. And, you know, so there's even those little moments where I know that everything stops once they mention Watergate, but I hadn't even just thought of like the reinforcing detail of like how clever that is, that the typewriter's happening, they're still working. And the thing that sort of stops them in their tracks is that someone's actually mentioning their goddamn story finally. And look, later on, it's the story and they just have to keep working through it. But this is a moment where they realize that. And so, yeah, I don't think there's anything to figure. We had a great guest, very fortunate to have John Boorstin on the show, who's actually, he's a filmmaker and a writer in his own right, but and work with Alan J. Pakula, the director, after this on another film, but was his assistant on set and was like with him through the whole movie and through the whole editing process. And for John, he's like Rosetta Stone to the movie is the bookkeeper scene, just because of filmmaking craft, of performances, of, you know, the authenticity and adherence to what is recorded as happening in real life. But you know, for him, that was like the moment of the movie that sort of synthesized that, like, in these conversations, there's this pervasive thing that's out there that's going to get them, you know? And although, like, I can totally agree with him on any given day that, like, the next moment you talk to someone else and you're like, no, the scene of the movie is the Dahlberg conversation scene where Redford is on the phone for 6 minutes. Or no, the scene of the movie is when they're rehearsing this, and there's such a music to that scene we've just gone through. So I don't know. And like then every Deep Throat scene comes up and every Bradley scene. So it's like, I don't know if there's any figuring out other than just the entire approach and the mercurial like care of like every performance and all the detail, plus then just actually these guys and guys and gals, particularly Jen Alexander, just coming up with these like magic, really beautiful, insightful, and like authentic feeling performances. You just like, I don't know, every part of this movie gets me. It excites me to tackle it, because also as you get through, I would imagine, like, you know, you being an obsessive film watcher, you know what it's like. It's like once you get to new stages and you unlock a new thought about something, it changes the way you watch it the next time. And so for me, like every revolving 20 minutes I'm preparing for the show and watching the show and then talking to people like yourself, then it unpacks like, oh, well, that's a really great moment. Now I want to pick up other moments where the sound design is underscoring what's also happening in a subtle way. You know, what is it doing to get me there in these other ways as well?
Yeah. I think absolutely what you were saying, but also that the news report scene, I think just the idea of like someone else is mentioning Watergate, other people are talking about this. I think, you know, now the notoriety of Watergate, the way that every scandal is a,
yes,
gate, right? Like we think of it as such, so second nature to how we talk about conspiracy theories or scandals or whatever, but it's like you can kind of almost forget there was an original. I will blame this on being Canadian, but I don't know the full history here. I certainly think there's so much more I have to learn about just like Nixon and Watergate and how all of that unfolded. And I think a lot of how I've learned about that history has been like secondhand references in other things.
Yes.
And it was very surprising when I sort of realized like the timeline of when this film was made versus when Watergate actually happened, like how quickly this film came about.
Yes. Yes. And
yeah, it's just incredible.
It's not only how quickly, because this, you know, you're Canadian, I'm Aussie. And so in America, the idea of a Hallmark film or a what is it, like straight to TV movie or like, there's sort of those like trashy, super quickly made topical dramatizations, and like each of our countries do our own trashy versions of them, but they're just popularized in America because of how big the population is, where they take like a modern thing, they recast famous people, they do a stupid, you know, straight to video thing, and it's always trash. It's just,
yeah, it's absolute, yeah,
the production,
the Lifetime movie version,
that's it,
of, you know, ripped from the headlines, Law and Order episode type thing.
Yes, it's complete, and 90% of the time it's trash. And Law and Order can sort of have actually been okay to navigate some of those popular cases. You know, they can do it pretty well in the mix of their shows. But mm-hmm. but to think that this movie, A, could be made, B, is made so brilliantly, and mm-hmm. and C, is made at a time when, you know, it's on, this is the, it's funny, it's like, this is the Rocky Academy Award year, you know, like people mm-hmm. are kind of done with Nixon mm-hmm. and Watergate, and they're like, I want out, like I want escape, I want triumph, I want the underdog back, I want, you know, those sorts of things, and you know, this is an as underdog a story as it gets, but I think that's what just genuinely shocks me, that you can make it with such care, you can make it for long term, and that people want to come back to it. And the only peer that, you know, contemporary peer that, you know, has been referenced on this show several times, but probably very importantly for you and I, is like The Social Network. Like, that, it's just shocking how close to the events of The Social Network was made, how much people still watch it. And now mm-hmm. I'll even sort of go, you know, in the world of Cambridge Analytica and all those things and Facebook, people are like, maybe Fincher didn't go far enough. Like, they could have Fincher and Sorkin could have gone really hard, and they actually were pretty conservative in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think just, I mean, like you said, the sort of like the way to sort of fast track any story in the headlines into like a film. I think what's so impressive about All the President's Men is how much it doesn't feel, you know, capitalizing on the sort of headline scandal, but it's actually going so deep into like the nuance and the complexity of this. It's not just that like sort of exploitation style, like we're going to give you all the like juicy details. Like they're really, this is not a juicy film. Like it's, you know, it's rich and it's rewarding, but it's not that sort of like gossipy scandal headline. It's so much more about the process to get there.
Yes. Yeah. And
I really like the Social Network comparison. I hadn't actually thought of that. But that's wonderful.
It's straight from Aaron Sorkin's lips. There's a great, he introduced All the President's Men, I think a couple of years ago at a special like New York, whether it was like a film festival or like as part of like a university or something like that, or part of a college mm-hmm. screening. And it's like, so see this movie, it's me ripping off William Goldman and All the President. This is me ripping it off at like relentlessly, you know, and Fincher and I being mm-hmm. sort of proteges of William Goldman, this movie would never have happened. But I think that's, you know, it's great peer. But I think also, like you said, and I had this distanced thing, and it's also because of our age, is Nixon is sort of omnipresent when you like is an omnipresent figure, because he's an omnipresent figure in cinema and he's in pop culture, and there's sort of that, you know, that pervasive American, you know, cultural imperialism that happens when you're in Canada and Australia. Mm-hmm. American texts are so dominant, even more so than your own local texts.
Yeah.
And so many of your great talent flocks to America to make great stuff. And so you have this sort of view. Mm-hmm. And that's the same for me. This movie's like a gateway drug. It is absolutely a gateway drug into Watergate. Like, if you're that kind of obsessed, mm-hmm. person, much in the same way. And look, you know, I love Oliver Stone too. And I think that Oliver Stone's JFK is absolutely the purest gateway drug into that and into the whole JFK conspiracy, much more overtly than this. You know, Oliver Stone is taking many dramatic liberties in how, because ultimately, you know, he calls himself a dramatist. He's not being there to be completely and wholly authentic in everything that he's doing. But he's like, I want to play around with all the facts that I know, and then do some really hardcore speculating. But I think that's a good way. Like, I think if a movie makes you want to finish it, and you feel like, you know, the great Roger Ebert says, like, as a film critic, like, when the movie's over, I've still got work to do. You know, I feel like if a movie makes you feel like you need to do more work, like I've got to go and research this, I want to read this thing, or there was a poem that was said in that movie, where was that from? And I feel like there are so many movies that just like are such blathering, passive enjoyment that anything that gets you to be like, I need to go revisit that again. I want to read this book. I want to find out more about these people. I'm going to go and do 5 hours of internet research, Googling every single person who made this movie. I feel like that's like, you're already winning.
Yeah. I like it when films assign me homework.
Yes. Yes. Please give me some homework.
Like that's kind of what it feels like. And I'm like, oh yes, thank you. I have a new obsession. Wonderful.
Oh good. I just opened this brand new booklet. So I've got some empty pages here to fill up. Yeah. No, it's certainly a place for the passive ones, but I don't know, by the sounds of things, you're a bit like me where it's like, oh cool. Great. A new thing that I have to be obsessed with now for a few months while I'm doing everything else. Are you, how familiar are you with the sort of paranoia genre? Because again, you and I, Australians, Canadians, there hasn't been really like, there's sort of not a litany of like paranoia thrillers that are originally in Oz. Like I think that you can see the international impacts of things like Watergate ripple through different other politics, and there've been some political scandals, but nothing in my mind that like leaps out as like, oh, someone's actually made the scandal movie in our country sort of thing. Like we had an Australian prime minister. I don't know if anyone like this is another homework assignment. This will be fun for you. There's an Australian prime minister who went swimming one day in the ocean and just never came back. Like that would be like the equivalent of like just going for a swim and he's just gone. And I can't remember there being like an amazing movie, a conspiracy movie about how he went for a swim and never came back. Like the country was just like, huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, oh, terrible accident. And I'm like, if that was America, there would be a whole subgenre of like what happened to the president. Like just because of the history and the sort of post-Vietnam paranoia, like no one could go missing. Like Jimmy Hoffa, you know, who has had 10 movies made about him by 20 people. And, you know, most recently Scorsese, The Irishman. It's like people go missing. People are going to speculate about what they'll happen. There's going to be lots of cool fictions. There's going to be all that. And yeah, it's really, really interesting that it sort of didn't happen in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's so interesting. I've never even heard of that.
Yeah. Well, has there been like, is the conspiracy thriller something that happens in Canada?
So the last Canadian angled political film I can think of is Run This Town, the Rob Ford movie that I did not see and probably won't. Heard it wasn't great. I mean, I'm a bad Canadian. I'm definitely no expert on like Canadian film. There's not much that really springs to mind. Not that I can think of.
So for folks listening, Harold Holt was our prime minister who went missing actually went missing in 1967. So he was in Victoria and disappeared.
This podcast just gave me homework.
There you go. I'm sorry.
When this ends, I'm going to go and research that all night.
that's just one of those things where I'm like, it may right around the same time as this, I'm just so shocked that there wasn't like 10 movies about how an Australian prime minister can go for a swim and just disappear off the face of the earth. Like, you know, could have very plausible that he just could have died. We have, you know, a pretty hardcore ocean and sharks and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. But yeah, I'm still quite shocked at that. Now, in your experience and in your sort of obsessive movies and that sort of termite art kind of movies, I know you're a fan of Zodiac, but are you feeling... When you're going back to sort of this movie, have you seen much of the sort of paranoia genre? Like, is that something that you're familiar with yourself? Like the Alan J. Pakula films, like the Parallax and Clued, are they on your watch list or have you sort of explored much of that genre? Because I feel like there's a great kinship in those more obsessive movies that they kind of, a lot of the paranoia movies are about obsessive people and you kind of watch them have that obsessive, you know, whether it's Blow Up, the Antonioni film, whether it's Blowout, De Palma, you know, The Conversation, Francis Ford Coppola, like those guys are all complete and utter obsessives, and there is something mm-hmm. riveting about watching them.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Absolutely big fan of those. I haven't seen Parallax. I love Clute. I mean, it's great. What's not to love? Fantastic movie. Just wonderful cast, wonderful film. Super impressed by that one. I mean, you mentioned Blowout, which is probably my third favorite movie of all time.
There you go.
I love it. It's a perfect film. I just actually yesterday did a little what I called a Sadder De Palma marathon, where I just watched a few De Palma films I haven't seen. But yeah, Blowout's one of those films that like I have probably watched like three times within the last year. I like just recently finally purchased it on Criterion, so I'm excited to get that in the mail and watch it just obsessively because it's wonderful. Blow Up, I think, is very good. I don't love it the way I love Blow Out, but I do think it's very good.
Did you see
and, yeah, the conversation?
Did you see Blow Up first?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I saw Blow Up and then Blow Out. And like, Blow Up, I was like, this is good. It's not my favorite Antonioni, but I was like, this is good. I respect it. There's a lot of craft here. And then Blow Out, I was just like,
yeah, I'm more of a love. I'm love into a Red Desert guy. I'm more, bring me some Monica Vitti.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. La Notte, maybe my favorite.
Yeah.
So good.
Very good.
But yeah, Blowout, I just like, give me like a cape of that film and I will wrap myself in it. You know, like I love it. It's so good. And yeah, I mean, conversation, wonderful. What could be better? Yeah, I mean, I like it. It's funny because when I did Travis's Inherent Vice podcast, part of what we talked about was Night Moves.
Yes.
I think that also like in here, this sort of just like conspiracy, obsession, anything like that. Yeah, I mean, the '70s, fun decade.
It's coming back. We're bringing it all back, Anna.
Yeah, exactly.
Obsession, crazy people trying to topple things, feeling like you're constantly being watched, followed, social upheaval. It's all happening. It's all happening. Mm-hmm. Look, it's been a real treat to talk to you. Thank you so much for plying your wares on this show. And I really appreciate especially even just something as subtle as the sound design underscoring that. It's always so good to get those fresh insights. Where can people find you? Where can people find your joyous and delightful and enjoyable Twitter that currently has an avatar of Elaine?
Yes. Yeah, you can find my Twitter Anna Swanson, but like no vowels in Swanson. So Anna SWNSN. Yeah, you can find me on there. You can find me writing stuff at Film School Rejects. Got a couple of things in the works that are, you know, we're making moves on. Got some James Bond stuff that I'm chipping away at, a whole little James Bond series. But yeah, got some stuff going on. And elsewhere at some point.
Elsewhere at some point. Well, look, hopefully people can see you outside of the house and elsewhere at some point. But until then, they'll have to deal with it. I have to follow you closely online with James Bond. Thank you so much for being a part of the show, and I really appreciate it. And
thank you for having me.
That was the awesome Anna Swanson. You can find her on Twitter at Anna SWNSN, or go to Film School Rejects. If you check out the description of this show, you'll also see both of those links to her. And if you're a fan of other One Heat Minute production, she's actually on episode 28 of Increment Vice with our very own Travis Woods, a ripper of an episode. They're absolutely fun together, and they spend the opening of the episode essentially harassing each other about how he hadn't invited her on sooner because she was so excited to talk to him. A barrel of laughs. Anna, thank you so much. You were wonderful on both One Heat Minute productions. Guys, thank you so much for listening. One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter is where you can find me. You can also find the show at ATPM Pod on Twitter. Reach out or hit us up on email, mail@oneheatminute.com. And finally, Patreon.com/oneheatminute. If you want more One Heat Minute action, bonus stuff, and you want to support us, for $5 a month, you can get an extra episode a week of the Rum and Rant podcast. But we'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes today, actually.